wonderful dear friend of mine, Lisa D. from Conscious Contact.
Woo-hoo! Lisa!
Well, Dorothy was right. There is no place like home. There is just no place like home. And when I'm in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, whether there's two people or 2,000, I know that I am home. So I hope you feel the same way, too. Welcome home. My name is Lisa D., and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Lisa.
I want to thank the committee for having me tonight. My family and friends know that I am the wild card in this bunch. And what an honor. I am overwhelmed with gratitude for a girl like me to be in a place like this to celebrate Bill Wilson's 82nd sobriety date. How amazing is that? I want to say thank you to the man in my home group who felt that I could do this, who nominated me to speak before you tonight. And I want to also acknowledge my parents who are here. Their names are Annette and Lou. They are 76 and 78, respectively. And I also want to acknowledge my sister, Donna, who is here as well. She's my younger sister, and I love her. She has always been the wind beneath my wings. And I would like to acknowledge my boyfriend, Steve S., because anyone who knows him knows how enthusiastic he is about Billy and Bobby's textbook, and I am privileged to walk shoulder to shoulder on this journey with him. I also want to give a shout out to my home group, which is Conscious Contact. We meet on Sunday at 11 a.m. and we meet at St. Patrick's Church cafeteria. You are all welcome. Let us know if you're all coming at once. We'll need to get extra bagels. But we are a meeting based in Solution, a literature-based meeting on the 3rd and 11th step, alternating weekly, and I invite you all to come. And the last but not least, I would like to just say hello to my friends that are here and some of the warrior princesses that I am privileged to sponsor. And I am... Yes, some of them are here. And so... My name is Lisa D., and my sobriety date is February 21st, 2009. I already told you my home group, and I want to tell you that I have a sponsor. Her name is Meg H. She's not here tonight. She lives in Florida, but she's here in my heart. And why will I even tell you my story? Because my story might set someone free. Your story set me free. And today I am a free girl, and I'll tell you a little bit about that. Before I start to tell you about how it was for me when I picked up a drink, I have to explain to you how it was for me before I picked up a drink. When I was 5 years old, I packed my sister and myself up and I ran away and I took her with me. And before I ever picked up a drink, I was running away and taking hostages. And that's really my story. And so I, my family is Italian American and they are very dark complexion, olive skin with dark hair, and I wasn't. This is a dye job. And so when I was growing up, I had a big red afro and freckles and braces, and I just didn't look like them. And I wanted to retreat inside of myself. That's how I felt growing up. I was a very shy kid, and I was a picked-on kid, and I had a big red afro, and I was the Italian-American version of Pam Grier, except that she was a foxy lady, and I was a social misfit, and that's really how it was. And so... When I was a kid, I just wanted to sink into myself. I loathed myself terribly, and I just wanted to hide, really. And the one feeling I remember before I ever picked up a drink is that I was afraid. I was afraid of you. I was afraid of me. I was afraid of the dark. I was afraid of everything. And I was so picked on that my father bought me a Bozo the Clown blow-up doll so that I could punch it in our garage so that I could protect myself because I was picked on. And I did. I punched that Bozo the Clown until my knuckles were swollen. And so right before I even picked up a drink, it was me against the world. And I have to tell you how that was because, see, if you were me at 14 years old, you would have drank too. And I needed to drink. And so I don't come from an alcoholic family. I want to tell you that my first drink was around the age of 14 years old. And when I picked up alcohol, it was like I discovered the letter M in the alphabet. And that is men, marijuana, masturbation, Maybelline, and moonshine. And that's really my story. Ask my parents, they'll tell you. I had a spiritual awakening, and the love of my life has always been booze, from the very first gulp I drank alcoholically, because I just love the effect produced by alcohol. What it did for me and what it did to me is it allowed me to be with you and okay in the world, and that fear left me, and for the first time in my life I could breathe, and I wasn't angry, and I wasn't bullied anymore. I was okay, and that's what it did for me. It allowed me, it gave me a personality change sufficient enough to live inside of me. And so I fell in love with it, and I drank, and there were consequences to pay immediately when I drank. So when I was 15 years old, I started hitchhiking in my Catholic high school uniform, and I was getting in cars because at 15 years old, it wasn't that easy to get booze. And so I would get in cars with dirty old men and exchange sexual favors for a glass of alcohol. And it's okay that I can say that to you today because that's not who I am today. And at 16 years old, my appendix burst in my parents' house because I had gone septic. I had contracted a sexually transmitted disease that would have been curable by a dose of penicillin, but it went undetected because I was always drunk already every day at 16. And so I went to the hospital, and that was the first time that I had a near-fatal life experience. And what that did for me is what happened the next day is the doctors told me that I would never have children because my reproductive organs were destroyed, and that was okay. But what that was for me, it was my ticket to drink. It was my ticket to drink because it was me against the world. And see, I drink at any cost. I have an allergy and obsession with alcohol, and I drink no matter what. At 17 years old, my father told me that if I was going to live under his roof, that I had to live by certain rules, and I knew I couldn't do that. I couldn't do that because I needed to drink. So I left. I left home, and I came into Manhattan. I was a teenage runaway, and I moved into the city, and I went into a shelter for teenage runaways, but unfortunately, I needed to drink. So I was removed from that shelter, and I lived in the street, and that was 1982. It was the day after I graduated from high school. And so I had been to a couple of meetings along the way. My parents didn't know what to do with me. They just wanted to keep me safe. They didn't get the handbook. And it was impossible to keep me safe. No human power could have rescued me. So I continued to drink. And in Times Square in 1982, it wasn't a safe place for anybody to be, especially a little Italian girl that was drunk. And so I danced in peep shows to support my habit, and I stayed out there. And I tell you this because, see, I really didn't think that my drinking was affecting anyone but me. And so I remember I got scared one day, and I took a yellow checker taxi cab home. And when, and just like that guy, I can't remember what I was saying, but I took a yellow checker taxi cab home, and I was like that that guy that came out of the bunker after the tornado and just said, "Look what a nice day it is." That was me. And so I showed up at my parents' house unannounced, and my mother opened the door, and this is what I remember. I remember seeing all the bones in her neck because she was so skinny, and it's a good thing my father was standing behind her because she went down. That's what my alcoholism did to me. It changed the path of my life, and it changed the path of my family's life too. And so I'd like to tell you that I got sober at that time, but that didn't happen. But 3 years later, I wound up in the hospital again, and I did get sober for the first time. It was January 21st, 1985. I was 20 years old. I got sober, and I stayed sober, and I came to AA, and I had a great life for a very short time, 6.5 years, actually. And so I got sober, and just by mere fact of putting down a drink, my life changed. It got better. I met a guy. I got married to another sober alcoholic. I went back to college, and I graduated second in my class with a 3.93 GPA. I ran marathons and biathlons, and from the outside looking in, it looked like a perfect life, except, see, there was something still wrong in me, because all that time in AA, and I want to tell you, it was a great part of my life, but what I didn't know is that I had a spiritual malady that was going to kill me, that I had never addressed. I had a sponsor, I did steps, I did what was available to me at the time, but something happened inside of me and I was very sick again, and I was trying to tell people, you know, is this it? I went to 3 meetings a day at that time. So let me tell you how I picked up a drink. I got separated from that man and I sold my engagement ring and I got on a plane with another friend of mine who was in AA. Her name was Arlene. May she rest in peace. But at that time, we got on a plane together, and we were going to celebrate our newfound singleness. She had also just recently got separated, and we went to Cancun. And we went to Cancun, and we were there for about 5 nights. And on the fifth night, the last night, we went to dinner, and we ordered some drinks. Virgin margaritas. I want to tell you something. There's just no such thing as a virgin margarita in Cancun. And so probably not anywhere, but definitely not in Mexico. And so we ordered those drinks, and just like Jim, when he decided to pour that whiskey in his milk, I had the vague thought that this might not be a really good idea. But the first drink came, and it had alcohol in it, and I didn't say anything to her, and she didn't say anything to me, so we ordered another round. And then we ordered another one. And I knew something probably wasn't going to turn out good. But see, when that thought of alcohol comes in and that obsession was on me and the phenomenon of craving had kicked in, alcohol always wins over every other thought. That's what obsession is. And so I vaguely remember getting on the back of a motorcycle with my new friend, Jose Cuervo, and we rode off into the night, and Arlene and I, we were together, you know. And so the next day, when I came to, I was on a chicken farm in Mexico, and I dusted myself off, and I yelled out, "Arlene, where are you?" And she said, "Lee, I'm here." And I said, "We have a plane to catch." And we got on that plane, we came back to New York, and we went to an AA meeting that night, and we pretended like that never happened. And it was just a matter of days and weeks, because see, what I already told you is I have an allergy to alcohol, and that obsession and that phenomenon of craving had kicked in. And see, I didn't have a solution to me, so alcohol became one again. And it was what took 6.5 years to create, only took 3 weeks to destroy. And I picked up a drink again, and I was off. And it was on. I need some water. We have 6 minutes. Okay. So, gotta speed this up a little. And so I would drink, and I already told you that my sobriety date was February 21st, 2009. And it was a very long, dark road, and it was ugly, and it was bad. I did dirty things with disgusting people in dark places, and I'd like to tell you more about that, but I want to get to the good part. And the part that, you know, happened right before I came here, because I worked in bars for 17 years of my life, and in that insanity, I thought I'm never going to get sober. And I had been in and out of AA, and I couldn't put together more than 30 days or 60 days ever in that time period. I think one time I might have put 108 days together. But what happened was I became a nurse in all that insanity, and the last 3 years of my drinking were absolutely horrific. And they were dark, and they were sad, and they were lonely, and the only person left in my life was my little dog, Lola. And I had distanced myself from my family so much. What happened was a sequence of events happened. A sequence of events happened. On my last drink, it wasn't my worst drink, but it was a dark, dark, dark time in my life, and I just wanted it to be over. I thought I would die. And I used to leave notes in my apartment so that the coroner could guesstimate my time of death. That's how I drank. There was no more fun in drinking for me. And a sequence of events happened, and I was drinking for 6 days. I left my house because I didn't think I had enough booze in the house to get through the night. And I got in trouble that night. I got arrested. And when those handcuffs went on, freedom set in. The gig was up. I didn't have another plan. I went home that next day, and I sat on that bar stool where I had drank by myself for 3 years, and I picked up the phone. But before I did that, for the first time, I asked God sincerely for help. I asked God for help sincerely for the first time. Janis Joplin says, freedom's just another way of nothing left to lose. I didn't have anything left to lose. I was a shell. I was shredded from the inside out, and I needed God. And I needed you. And I picked up the phone and I asked for help. And you know, it's a funny thing. God doesn't make too hard of terms for those who seek him. And my journey began. I went to my first AA meeting that day. And I got a sponsor. And I got a sponsor who was armed with the facts about my disease. And she told me that I would drink again. My first step was that I was going to drink again. My track record showed that left to my own resources, I would drink. And that I needed some kind of power, and I needed to do things differently, and that I needed to concede to my innermost self that I couldn't drink safely, and I was willing to do that because I had nothing left. Nothing. And so we started this journey, and we started walking through the steps. And what happened somewhere in that journey, I think it was around step five for me after I shared all of my stuff with her, is that that channel that blocked me from you and from God, it started opening. And I remember standing in the sunlight, and I have to tell you something. This is the really good part, because when you haven't been in sunlight in so long, and it's so dark, how dark it is before the dawn, when that sun hit my face, and I stood in the sunlight of the Spirit at last, it's really, really hard to go back into the darkness after you stand in the sun. And I got a taste of that, and I kept walking this journey. And the thought was, you know, maybe God could love me too, because I really didn't think God would ever shed his light upon me. And I thought, you know, maybe I am one of God's kids too. And what I learned was that God loves the broken ones. God loves the broken ones. Yes, he does, because I am one, and I am one of God's kids today. I know that with full certainty, and I kept marching this march, and I kept walking this walk, and I went through those steps, and by the time I got to my 12-step, my first sponsor, a couple of months later, a girl asked me to sponsor her, a lady, and I was so scared, and I called up my sponsor, and I said, you know, this lady asked me to sponsor her. She had 17 years, and she was sponsored by the gurus of Alcoholics Anonymous. What am I going to offer her? She knows that big book was so much better than me. And she said, what did you say? I said, yes. And she said, well, that's what you're supposed to say, and I'll help you. And I started this journey, and what that did is it opened the door to allow me to help some of God's most amazing women who set me on fire, who saved my life. Working with others is absolutely the bright spot in my day, because, you know, like, I know this is all about Bill, but Dr. Bob was asked, why do you help other alcoholics? And he said four things. A, it's a pleasure. Two, a sense of duty. Three, because I'm trying to repay the men that helped me when I walked in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And four, every time I help another alcoholic, it ensures me immunity from a slip. And that is true. That's been my experience. And today I want to tell you that I've had a different spiritual experience today, and that I'm free, and that I'm not that 14-year-old girl that hitchhiked, and I'm not that 17-year-old girl that lived in the streets What I am, or I'm trying to become with God's help, is a woman of grace and dignity, a worker among workers, a daughter, a sister, a friend, a girlfriend, a good sponsor, a good sponsee. My life is absolutely beyond your wildest dreams for a girl like me to be in a place like this. And I can't believe my 20 minutes are almost up, so I'm going to wrap it like a present right now. I am 52 years old. I just opened a pension plan. And now is as good a time as any to start a pension plan. But the ironic part is that I never thought I would live to see 52 years old. And in my active alcoholism, I always thought that if there was a God, that I would meet God face to face. But He brought me to you. And in here, I have met God heart to heart, from my heart to your heart. I want to say thank you for my sobriety. Pass it on.
Thank you, Lisa. As always, I get to hear Lisa a lot, and she's always amazing, and that was wonderful. Sincerely, thank you. Okay, and tonight, second we have, from Brooklyn, just for tonight, Mitch Gay.
All right.
Oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy. Lisa, thank you so much. Before I get started, can I get everybody to get to the center of the room? I want to take a selfie with everybody. You from up there? My name is Mitchell Kashetsky, and I'm a recovered alcoholic. Before I get started, I seen a couple of people cringe just now when I said recovered. Let me just explain myself. Doesn't mean I'm not an alcoholic. When I pass on 5 days later, I'll be buried, and I'll still be an alcoholic. I recovered from a sense of hopelessness. I recovered a sense of wholeness inside of me, and I recovered a sense of sanity. I recovered from a compulsion to drink on a daily basis. But I will always be an alcoholic, because like Lisa said, I had to concede to my innermost self to that, and that I did a long time ago. And with that, I want to say thank you to New York Intergroup, to the committee, the chair, and all those who helped me get up here tonight, especially the ones who supported me and said, Mitch, don't worry about it. Just go up there. You're a vessel of God. Just carry a message. Whew, still scary, though. And I tell you, I was scared up until the minute I came downstairs. Me and my wife left the room. I came downstairs, all dressed, got into the lobby, and I seen a friend of mine. And she's like, you doing all right? I was like, now I am. Now I am. Because I got to see one of us. And that calmed me down a little bit. Honey, hi. This really is terrifying. But anyway, let's get on with that. Like I said, my name is Mitchell Kashetsky, and I'm a recovered alcoholic. I'm grateful to be here tonight. I'm grateful to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's such a pleasure that I get to live a day at a time without picking up a drink anymore. And that wouldn't be possible without the help of everybody in this room. I have a sponsor. It's a love-hate relationship. I hate that man. Because he helped me find out about myself. I love that man. Because he helped me find out about myself. You know, I've read the Big Book 3 times. Once when I was in prison, once when I was in jail, once when I was in rehab. I find myself to be fairly intelligent, and I understood word none of that big book. None. He walked me through that book like a little child with patience and tolerance and helped me find out about me and my disease, our disease. And that's why I say I love that man. I have a home group. It's Greenwood in Brooklyn. Yeah, baby. For those of you who don't know Greenwood, It's the room with all the whales on the wall. There you go. Used to be a longshoreman's club. Go figure. Still got a bar in it. Thankfully not stocked. It has coffee now, just so everybody's clear about that. Love my home group. You want to practice the principles of tolerance and patience? Get involved with your business meetings. Sobriety at its finest. That's where you learn how to grow in sobriety. And I love my home group for that. I love my home group because those are my people. I'll tell you something. More my family than my family. You know, that's who I turn to. My wife, my daughter, and my family from Greenwood, my family in Alcoholics Anonymous. Let's see, January 15, 2011 is what I consider my sober date. And why do I say it like that? January 9, 2011 was the last day I had my glass of Glenlivet at 10 p.m. at night. January 14, 2011 was the last day I took any medication inside the detox I was in. January 15, 2011 was the last day I put any mind-altering substance into my body for the first time with my decision to do so. And that's why I say January 15, 2011. The truth of the matter is, I don't know, I consider that clean, abstinent. My sobriety date, probably about 6:15 this morning from when I woke up to right about now. That is how much sober time I have. I base my sobriety on how I carry myself throughout the day, not about picking up a drink today. That's the easy part with the help of this program. It's the easy part once I got to learn about myself. The hard part is to carry on like that on a daily basis so I don't have to pick up a drink and a drug again. How do I do that? Stupid little things. I notice people think I'm crazy when I say this. I'm walking down the street, I have a coffee cup in my hand or a piece of paper. I don't throw it on the floor no more. I walk the extra 15 feet to a garbage can. That's part of being a sober human being in my eyes. Somebody's walking in the door behind me. I don't slam it shut and say, he should have been here 2 seconds ago. I hold the door. Sober living. That's how I judge my sobriety today. Now, am I perfect at it? Absolutely not. Go to table 132. Her name is Marissa. That's my wife. She'll tell you that with glee. I'm definitely not perfect at it, but I try my best. The program tells me I'm never going to be perfect. In my eyes, there's only one perfect being, and that's my higher power, who I choose to call God today. And it's not me, thankfully. I gave up me being higher power about 6 years ago. So I try my best on a daily basis. That's what I do. I grew up in Brooklyn. You know, it's funny. I tell people I grew up in Idaho. They're like, really? I'm like, no. I grew up in Brooklyn. Place called Canarsie. I live in Park Slope now. I grew up in Canarsie. I was like that red-headed Jewish stepchild in a predominantly Italian neighborhood at the time. And things just didn't work right. Everybody had the Christmas tree. I had the menorah. You know, my hair was red. Most of my friends had black hair. My name ended in a Y. Most of theirs ended in a vowel. I know how that 14-year-old, believe me, I know. I understand. Things just, my clothes were never good enough. My bike was never good enough. My family was never good enough. My father, very humble man, very calm man. The man never cursed a day in his life. Never wanted for more than what we had. Never needed for it. Black and white TVs, and I couldn't understand that. Everybody has a color TV remote control, and I got a black and white TV. It didn't make sense to me. I'm so thankful that he's alive, and I get to tell him I wish I was more like him when I was growing up. My mother, on the other hand, was a little high-strung. Could beat the heck out of me and my sister 2 minutes later, hug us on the couch and watch TV. I was like, nothing ever happened. That might have been a little confusing. Now, do I blame them for my disease? Absolutely not. Under no circumstances do I blame them for this. I was called rambunctious as a child. Thanks to the help of Alcoholics Anonymous and that wonderful big book, I learned three other magical words. When an alcoholic doesn't have a drink in him, he gets irritable, restless, and discontent until he has the next drink. That was me growing up my entire life. Three magical words I never knew existed until I heard it in Alcoholics Anonymous, but that was me. I'm one of these people who truly believe that dis-ease was in me long before I picked up a drink. The drink just calmed it. The drink took that dis-ease and made it ease and comfort. We talk about how the alcoholic loves the feeling that alcohol gives us. For me, it was the ease and comfort. It was such a relaxing feeling. What else could a young child do except grow up and enjoy it and embrace it after that? I am a great alcoholic. What do we say? Prideful, self-centered, egotistical, all run by an inferiority complex. That sums it up for me. And that was me growing up my entire life. Like I said before, nothing was ever good enough, so I went out and got it. Out on the streets, I took to a life of crime, to the older guys out on the streets with the rope chains and the Cadillacs. And the, you know, I was a young kid robbing stores, doing things for them and making money. And that's how I thought I had to live. I got that drink in me as a little kid. You know, we were 12 years old in Brooklyn. We were able to get alcohol in Brooklyn because they were afraid not to sell it to us. So we used to, you know, going at 12 years old, you know, there's the normal stuff, you know, on the corner in the park, you get your little beers. And then we moved up to some of you might remember this, some of you might not. I'm not going to point out who's going to remember it. Tango. It was the pre-made screwdrivers. You know, we used to get into the park, we'd drink it, we'd have a great time, and the older guys in the neighborhood were like, yeah, let's go do that. And we'd all for it because we're with the older guys. And, oh, man, it was great growing up like that, right? The insanity was normalcy. Man, became normalcy. But I'll never forget the real, true first drink I had. I had a party with the older guys and had a bottle of tequila. And I took that tequila and I downed it. And now you hold it upside down and the worm drips to the bottom and you get the worm out and you drink it and you get that burning, disgusting, nauseous feeling. But you're never going to let anybody know, right? We're alcoholics. You're not going to let nobody know we're hurting. And a guy grabbed me. He's like, look at the way he could drink. That was the warm comfort that I embraced. That made me part of. That's my arrival point in life. And once that happened, there is no way Mitch was going through life without alcohol. It just wasn't possible. I'm an alcoholic. I like to say I grew into my disease. I really did. And I really took to it and embraced it. So somewhere in December 2010, my wife very calmly, very nicely, didn't give me an ultimatum, didn't do none of that. She says, you know something, the way you're acting, the things you're doing, you're going to kill us. It's going to kill our relationship. You need to do something about this. I'm like, what's wrong with this girl? She's sick. What is she talking about? They're disappearing in after hours till 7, 8 in the morning, the blackouts, disappearing for weekends and nights at a time. What is she talking about? It's going to kill us. It's fine. Why? I'm an alcoholic. This is normalcy to me. You know, but she's like, you can't keep doing this. And she didn't threaten me, nothing. She did a great 12-step job on me. You need to take care of this. Her brother at the time, my brother-in-law, says, Mitch, when you're ready for help, let me know. So I'd be glad to help you because he had some time at that point and he still does, thank God. And the first decision I made that made any sense, I must have really been out of my mind at that point, and that's when God entered my mind, because it wasn't me saying I'm going to go to rehab. Definitely wasn't my thoughts, but something did, and I went. I'll never forget going to detox first. I went to a detox, 7 days there. They tell me go to rehab. I'm like, you people are insane. Did you hear my story? I have 4.5 years in prison, 2-3 years in Rikers, a week in federal lockup. Rehab, what's that going to do for me? My wife, there she goes again. My higher power was working through her. I like to say she's the real alcoholic. She pulled a backdoor move on me. She turned around and said, at the time, it was January 2011, it was snow. We had like 18 inches of snow on the ground. And she tells me, you know, you said you wanted to go clear your head up. She might not remember this. She says, you wanted to go clear your head up. She says, the insurance is paying for you to go to Florida. What a fool she is. I'm an alcoholic. I'm going to Florida to relax. I got this beautiful brochure. Look at this. Where the couch is. They're on the intercoastal down in West Palm on a single island. Beautiful hi-hat ceilings. I can't wait to get there and relax. I'm going on a vacation paid for by the insurance company. How could I go wrong, right? Yeah. Man plans, God laughs. So I get down to this rehab down in Florida. I come off the plane, the almighty Mitch, here I am walking with two suitcases, leather jacket, pants, thermal, boots on, 900 degrees. They pick me up, they take me to this clubhouse down there. The guy's like, oh, everybody from the rehab, they're in the AA meeting, we're going to go over there and drop you off. I'm like, yeah, okay. What's wrong with this guy? Takes me in there, into this big clubhouse, and there's like 100 people. It's the end of the meeting, I'm standing in the back of the room. They're finishing the meeting, they all hold hands, and they start doing the Lord's Prayer. I'm like, welcome to AA. Not me. I went to the rehab, and every day I'd call my wife up, send me a plane ticket, 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 send me a plane ticket. And guess what? It was three men to a room. There was no hi-hat ceilings. But it wasn't on the intercoastal. I got to pet the thing, like, that looks like the walrus, the manta ray, I forgot what they're called. I got to pet manatee, yeah. I got to pet one of those. That was pretty cool. But, thanks, Michelle. You know, she tells me, yeah, call me later, I'll send you a plane ticket. By then, somebody talks to me and calms me down, the big tough guy. And I finally meet my counselor. This is where it gets interesting. I can't tell you the whole story. Pretty blonde girl, and I'm an alcoholic, so you know where my mind is going. And this sweet young girl teaches me, proves to me that I'm an alcoholic. She says, Mitch. I said, no, all I got to do is stop partying. She says, no, you're an alcoholic. She says, I'm going to prove it to you. She says, walk me through a normal social setting. So I do. I'm putting on my suit, tie, glass of scotch or two in my hand, talking about how great I look. I get downstairs to the car, go to the bodega. I grab two or three Heinekens for the car ride, even if it's only 5 minutes away. I get to the social event like this, God bless, first thing I would have done was beeline right to the bar, boom, here's $20, give me Johnny Walker straight up, if it gets halfway full, make sure it gets refilled. Sit down at my table, you're my waiter, see this glass of Johnny Walker, if it gets half empty, make sure it gets refilled, bring me a bucket of beers to keep him under the table, here's $20. She says, Mitch, you couldn't function in a social setting without drinking. She says, now think back over your whole life. She made me an alcoholic. Then I come here and all you people really solidified it. So I come home, I listen to her. I come home, I put my hand up my first two meetings. I was like, this ain't my Brooklyn, this is not for me. These people are talking about weirdos and degenerates and shit. The third meeting I go to is my home group. Stick me in a men's meeting at 11 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday, packed with 50 guys. I'm like, oh, after this, I'm out of here. My higher power spoke through somebody else, did for me what I couldn't do for myself. I heard this gentleman, Bobby, speak. I was like, this guy, I understand. I heard this guy, Tommy, how you doing? I'm Tommy G. I said, oh, this guy, I understand. And from then it was on, AA. I stayed, and I will continue to stay. I went through that book like I'm supposed to. I learned about myself. I did it with a sponsor that I always tell you need to get. Let them help you. Let us help you. That's what we're here for, to help each other. And it works well. I wouldn't be standing up here without the help of some of the people in this room who gave me the encouragement and reminded me it's going to be okay. Why? Because I'm in a room of alcoholics. I'm safe. Nothing to fear up here. So if you're new, stay. Get a sponsor. Do the work. I'm not a big book thumper, but believe me, it helps. Those steps will do the most important thing for you that you'll never be able to do for yourself. Help take a look at you and change you. There's a couple of things I'm going to leave you with before I get off that I always like to say. There's a forward to the first edition. In all four editions, it says precisely how we recovered. It doesn't say do step one, go to one meeting a month, throw in a 13th step, now go back and do a fourth step. No. It says we suffered, so you don't have to suffer anymore. Here's the prescription. Between the third and the fourth step, it says liquor is merely a symptom. I'm paraphrasing. Liquor is but a symptom. The real problem lies within here. And once you get right with that, and you get right with God and the world, stay that way. Dr. Bob once said, and no, I didn't hear him say it. You know, I heard it through a CD. If you don't understand the 12 steps, summarize it to 6 words. And I truly believe if you can incorporate these 6 words into your life on a daily basis, then on a daily basis you can stay sober. Trust God, clean house, and help others. 6 words was his prescription. Put that into your life and live that 6 words a day at a time. And I truly believe you'll stay sober a day at a time. Now I'm going to let you go with this. I truly believe what I believe the true message of Alcoholics Anonymous is: hope. Ebby gave hope to Bill. Bill gave it to Bob. Bob and Bill gave it to the man on the bed. Hope. If you're in this room right now and you had a drink let's say 3 hours ago, there's hope for you because you are in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous and an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting with hundreds of people who are sober today. Don't give up that hope. Keep coming and keep the hope alive for yourself and those sick and suffering that are about to enter these rooms. I love you all and thank you for allowing me to come here.
Okay. Mitch, thank you. Really good to hear you. Our third speaker, I actually didn't get to hear during the speaker selection, so I took their word on it. But I have, I know him. I've seen him around. I see him do a lot of service in Area 49, and I've got to hear him talk about other things. And I have a feeling this will be very enjoyable. So without ado, I will bring up Steve G.
I'm an alcoholic. My name's Steve.
Hi, Steve.
I just told my wife I got to go to the bathroom. I went twice before. I was trying to time it right, but there's 2 times that I drink: when I want to and when I don't want to. And that's pretty much my story. Thanks for coming. I spoke at the Atlantic Group a few years ago. There were about maybe a quarter of the people there, and this is a little overwhelming for me. Whew. There's something in the book about, they call it the age-old riddle that we can't answer. And I think it's why did I become an alcoholic? Why me? Why can't I drink like normal people? And, my first sponsor told me that that's all psychobabble. If you really need to figure that out, you can figure that out, but just know that there's a solution, and if you're part of that, you're going to be okay. Face the facts that you have it, the disease, and do something about it, right? So, I never really worried too much about why or how come, but I was thinking about it, and my parents told me that when I was, a baby, there's this thing in the Jewish religion that they do called a bris, and it's when they circumcise a young Jewish boy, right? Usually done about, 10 days old or 2 weeks old, whatever it was. So when I was having mine, I don't remember this, but they told me that once the moil did his job, I started crying, and they put a glass of wine by my lips, and I stopped crying. And when they took it away, I started crying. So I don't know if that has anything to do with how I am today or why I am today, but I thought about it a little further, and I remember going to synagogue as a young boy, maybe 8 or 9, 10, and they have this thing after the service called the Oneg Shabbat, where everybody gets together and they eat little pastries and they drink little cups of wine. And I was drinking little cups of wine. I remember that, 9, 10 years old, and I felt this warm feeling. I don't know if I got, you know, drunk or anything, but it was cool, you know. And then fast forward a few more years, I was going to make my bar mitzvah at 13 years old, right? And I remember my parents never had liquor in the house, but they went out and they bought like a ton of liquor. And we ended up bringing a lot of it home. And after my bar mitzvah, for about the next 6 weeks or so, I managed to polish off all the liquor that was in the house. And so what I came to realize is that Judaism is the cause of my alcoholism. If I had just been raised Irish Catholic, I probably wouldn't have to go through all of this trouble that I'm going through now. So be it. You know, it really was true. I don't remember drinking a lot until I was about 13. And I was a good student, got straight A's, smart kid, you know. My family, we weren't rich, but I certainly didn't want for anything. They moved us out to the suburbs so that we could go to a nice school and have a house. And by the time I was 14, I was pretty much full-blown, you know, off to the races. I remember being 15 years old and getting arrested for stealing cars. And, you know, I was doing it because, you know, a friend of mine did it with me, and we had a good time. We're going out joyriding a little bit. It was fun. By the time I was 16, I was asked to leave high school. Smart kid, you know. And by the time I was 17, when my friends were filling out college applications and deciding where they were going to go and what they were going to do with their life, I was in the Yaphank Honor Farm doing a little bid. 17 years old, scared, you know. And the things that got me in there were the exact things I did when I got out. I couldn't wait to get out and go back to the craziness, you know. And my 20s were horrendous. I don't even remember half of them. You know, I like what Mitch said about the tango. That was one of my drinks, you know. I remember getting tango, Rhine wine, MD-2020, stuff like that. Started out, you know, with like a flask bottle of Southern Comfort on a Friday night. Southern Comfort turned into Jack Daniels, Jim Beam, Wild Turkey. And those became tequila after a little while. And on my 25th birthday, I remember doing 25 shots of tequila. I thought I was like the man, you know. And I was at this bar, and an old girlfriend had come down to the bar with her new boyfriend. And I don't know what I did, but I'm sure it was a mess. After a while, I had to only drink things that were clear. So I went to vodka. And that's where it ended. You know, when I was asked to be nominated to speak here, which I want to thank the committee and thank all the people doing service, I was told, don't talk about drugs and don't curse, right? So you don't know for how long. It's been like since the middle of September I knew I was going to speak here. I was trying to figure out how I was going to weave a couple curses and some drugs into my talk, you know? Let's just say I did a lot of non-conference approved material. Okay? And I don't know if that got me here faster or slower or whatever, but it's part of my story. So back to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, Mitch set a timer here. He said that if the other guys didn't go for the full 20 minutes, that I'd have some extra time, but that's out of the picture. Like my good friend Dennis says, I have a hard time introducing myself in 20 minutes. I'm a member of the Gun Hill Group in the Bronx. And just so you know, we're having our 69th group anniversary on November 21st, which is like 2 weeks away. 3008 Bainbridge Avenue, corner of 201 in the Bronx. Again, like Lisa said, if you guys all show up at one time, probably need to not only bring your own chair, but maybe bring your own food and, you know, anything else you're going to need for the night, but you're all welcome. I've been a member of the Gun Hill Group for probably the past 9 years. I did get sober out in Long Island. My parents had moved us out to, there's a few people from Long Island here, right? I grew up in Center Reach, but then I ended up moving out to Riverhead because I met a woman, and I ended up getting sober out in Riverhead. I haven't had a drink this century. I got sober August 16th, 1999, but saying I didn't have a drink this century sounds a lot cooler than August 16th, 1999, right? Didn't sound so cool in 2002, but it sounds cool now, you know? By the grace of God, I just celebrated 17 years this past August, and I'm pretty happy for that. You know, when we talk about sobriety, I didn't get sober when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I got dry. Yeah. I was a periodic drunk. I knew how to stop. I just didn't know how to stay stopped. Once I had gotten married the first time, I had somebody who was monitoring my drinking. At first, she was my drinking partner, but then she kind of realized pretty fast that I definitely had a problem. I didn't know it, but she knew it, and everybody else knew it. So I went through this period of controlled not drinking. Right? I would go out on a Friday night after work with every intention of having a couple beers with the guys, happy hour, going to end up home on the couch watching TV with the kids. And that never happened, because Friday night turned into Saturday morning. 4 o'clock in the morning was never enough. I would get anxious. I'd be like, oh, my God, the party's going to end. Where do I go? What do I do? And I was a crash and burn drinker, meaning that I never put the glass down and said, I've had enough. I'm going home. I had to be taken off the road or, you know, sent home or locked up or whatever it was. And, you know, I always thought I was in the wrong place at the wrong time, victim of circumstance. After my third DWI, I cursed the cop up and down. I told him what I thought about his mom. I said, you know, what's going on here? You guys picking on me or what? So, yeah, I got lots of drunkalog stories, but the nice thing is I also have some sober stories. I'll just give you one of the drunkalog stories. My wife loves this story. It was maybe a month or two before my first wedding, and my wife-to-be and one of her bridesmaids were sitting in the kitchen, and I came home snot drunk, looking for sex, drooling, nose running, you know? And I said, you're going to have sex with me? And she said, why don't you have sex with my friend Karen? And I said, okay. And, you know, because right away I said, that's permission. You know, and in a drunken stupor, I went and had sex with her friend and got her pregnant. Yeah, yeah. Now my wife, my ex-wife, was very loyal. She made sure she took Karen to take care of business, what she had to take care of, because no bridesmaid of hers was going to be pregnant at her wedding, right? What? So let me just tell you about my new wife a little bit. My wife Michelle's here with me up on the dais because she wouldn't let me sit up here by myself. And I love her dearly, I really do. I don't need Google because I have Michelle. If I want to know something, I ask her. She knows everything. She'll tell me, no doubt about it. My family is sitting up there in the wings over there. It's actually her family, but you know what? They've adopted me. And I say that because in the early 80s, when I was about 18 or 19, my parents were going through separation and eventually a divorce. And my dad, once the divorce was finalized and he retired, he moved to San Francisco, and my mom moved to Sarasota, Florida, and neither one of them asked me to go. And they kind of just left me, you know, 19, ready to face the world. And, you know, my brother died at 33 years old of this disease. The last thing he told me before that night when he didn't come home was, there ain't nothing about recovery you can tell me that I don't already know. And he was in such denial. And I was too. But, you know, I do have a family today. I mean, I have people that love me. And I didn't, you know, I didn't get born into their family. They actually chose me, which I think is like beyond my wildest dreams. I just got the tap on the leg. Keep an eye on the time. So let me tell you about what happened after that third DWI. I was out in Jamesport, and I was at this bar on off of Peconic Bay Boulevard, right? And it's a one-light town. Everybody knows everybody. I pissed off the barmaid. She kicked me out. So I got in my car, and I drove back into Riverhead to look for the party. And a cop took me off the road. And again, I told you, I cursed him out, and I was upset. But he saved my life. I didn't know it at the time. So with help from the professional community, the cop, the judge, my probation officer, the counselor that I was remanded to, I was pointed towards Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't even know about Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I probably heard about it, but I didn't know what they did. I didn't know what it was about. I never thought I would need to because I certainly wasn't an alcoholic. I had no idea what an alcoholic was, but I knew I wasn't one. Because my idea of an alcoholic was an older guy with a beard, unkempt, long trench coat, bottle in his pocket, sleeping on a bench, right? And that wasn't me. I mean, I had a van. I had a motorcycle in my living room. It was a shovelhead, Steve. It was a shovelhead. You know, I was married. I had a job. I certainly couldn't have been an alcoholic. The counselor told me I had to start going to Alcoholics Anonymous, that he wasn't going to sign my paperwork to get my license back until I did, and that's what I wanted, right? That's what I wanted. I didn't wake up and say, hey, let me go check out what those guys are doing in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I was coerced, right? So I show up at this meeting that met on Sunday morning at the hospital out there. I think it's called Peconic Bay Medical Center now. It used to be called Central Suffolk. 8 o'clock in the morning, Sunday, met my busy schedule. And you could hear the laughter in the conference room coming down the hall. As soon as you got out of the elevator, you could hear the laughter. I'm wondering what these guys were laughing at, you know. And I figured I'd sit in on a few and see what was going on. I used to raise my hand and say, my name is Steve. I got a lot of problems. And I did. My mom passed away. I just got my third DWI. I lost my license. I had lots of problems. And I was listening to people talk in the meeting about their cats and drinking vodka from a shampoo bottle in the shower. And I was like, you guys are freaking nuts. I definitely don't belong here. But it wasn't long after that that I actually started to hear little bits of my story, you know, that language of the heart. And it wasn't coming from the guy with the tattoos or the motorcycle. It was from, you know, older men, younger women, just a variety of people who, you know, were going through the same thing that I was going through, but they had gone through it. And I had actually thought that they had gotten together before I got there and said, hey, that guy Steve's coming again. Let's say some stuff that he can identify with. Like, how would you know to say that stuff, right? And I started going to the meeting pretty regularly. It was, you know, at least 6 months before I would say I'm alcoholic. My name's Steve, and I only said that because I thought the first step said we admitted we were alcoholic. And I finally gave in and said, okay, I'll admit it. I didn't believe it. And it really didn't say that. It said we were powerless over alcohol, which couldn't be me because I wasn't powerless over anything, right? I was pretty powerful. I wasn't the poster boy for AA, let's put it that way. I was told, don't make any major changes. So I continued to cheat on my wife. I continued to steal from my employer. And I lied every chance I could get. I was a liar, cheater, and a thief, and those were my good qualities without a drink. I wasn't a nice guy who drank too much. I just wasn't. I thought I might have been, but I know I wasn't looking back now. And someone had talked about, you know, I felt like at one point an ostrich, how an ostrich will pull their head out of the sand and look around. And the reality was I couldn't put my head back in and deny it because this was my life. It was unmanageable, and I needed to do something about it. And that guy who told me about the psychobabble stuff, just get into the solution, he became my sponsor. And helped me through the first three steps. He kept me on him for a year. I don't know if there's any like right way, right time. But he ended up moving out to Oregon, and I had to get another sponsor. So I finally asked somebody. I asked Vinny the Pipe, who was the most miserable guy, but he was sober. He was sober probably close to 30 years at that point. And I did my fourth and fifth step with him. It was classic. I wrote down in this book, I brought the book over to his house, and we were sitting in his living room, and he had the shredder out. And as I was reading off pages from the book, we'd rip them out, and he'd run them through the shredder. And he told me that he did a couple of those things, too, and I wasn't unique. As a matter of fact, he told me, you're about as unique as a garbage can. I loved him. I really did. You know, I thought that I was stuck on 6 and 7 for a while. I was really stuck with not being able to let go of those things that weren't my character defects. They were my assets, the things that I used to get by in life. And it wasn't until I was in turmoil, I'm talking emotional turmoil, that I actually jumped back into the steps and really tried to do something. So it wasn't until about my third year without a drink that I actually started to get sober, you know? They used to say, you're growing a conscience. You're getting a belly barometer. The layers of the onion are peeling. I'm like, listening to these people, and I'm like, what are you talking about? You know? But believe it or not, I actually started thinking about other people and putting other people's feelings ahead of my own. It's unbelievable. So let's fast forward now. I end up getting a job teaching. One thing that I did that was smart, I guess, is that I went back to school. I did that while I was still drinking. But, you know, once I found out that I was able to take out loans, I figured, what the hell, right? I was smart. I could pass these classes. And if you stay in school, you don't have to start paying them back. So I got an associate's degree, a bachelor's degree, two masters, a couple graduate certificates. You know, my wife always says, you got all these letters after your name, but you're so stupid. High school dropout. Now I'm teaching eighth graders who are 14 and going down the same path that I had gone down when I was 14, you know, in the Bronx. Yeah. Nice white kid from Long Island. I came around the corner on 182nd Street and Fallen Avenue. I saw a burnt-out minivan. I was like, what the hell am I doing here? And now it's my home. And I love these kids. You know, I love them. I really do. I got two little guys. There's actually a new one, Kyle and Gio, grandkids, that they call me Papa. And they come running when they see me, Papa, Papa. And they run into my arms. And, you know, you can't buy that stuff. I mean, these are the things that that I have because I'm sober, you know? I've done a lot of service work in AA because I feel that if I lived to be 150 years old, I couldn't give back what AA gave to me. And I sometimes think that it's a job, but it's supposed to be fun, you know? And I also think that you don't have to be a rocket scientist to do service in AA. You just have to have two things, the availability and the willingness, right? So if you have some time and you want to give it a shot, there's plenty to do in AA. You know, the worst thing that could have happened to me was being asked to speak at this dinner dance, because I've like had this whole mental thing going on for 2 months, like, you know, what am I going to say? I want to carry the message, but I want to carry it so funny that, you know, everybody thinks I'm such a comedian and a great guy. I want to, you know, because I'm an egomaniac. I really am. You know, I'll give you a quick story because I got 18 seconds left. We went to the Bum Breakfast last week. That's the Bronx Upper Manhattan Spiritual Breakfast. And I've been going there for the past 6 or 7 years. And I drive this Chevy 2500 Series HD pickup truck. It's the King cab with the 8-foot bed. So it's like a car and a half. And I always park it in the Burger King parking lot across the street from the Eastwood Manor where the breakfast is. Well, never had a problem. Never had a problem. Someone gets up in front of the room and announces that if you're parked across the street, you need to move your vehicle. They're going to tow them. So I get up. I look at the people at my table. I said, I got to go move the vehicle. I walk outside. I look across the street. Truck's still there. I said, you know what? I'm going to roll the dice. I walk back in. I had breakfast. Telling jokes. I'm a great guy. The sinking feeling when I walked out there to get that truck and it wasn't there, you know? What makes me think that the rules don't apply to me? Why is that? That, you know, 17 years without a drink, I can still be such a jerk that I think that everybody should just bow down to me and let me, you know, do whatever I want. You know, I was going to read this thing out of the book, but I'm going to be asked to, unless I can read it.
Read it.
All right.
Lay it on me. I'm not the bad guy.
An ideal is a man's portrait of his better self. Louis Binstock. When in training for athletics, we use a daily routine to reach a peak condition. We stretch, lift weights, run, and do special conditioning to develop our bodies and skills for that big day of competition. It's hard work. Sometimes we hate it. But at other times, we do it just because it feels so good. Then when the day of competition comes, we can depend on that practice. At a crucial moment, there's not time to think about how we'll respond. We just do it the way we learned and use our physical ability to carry us through. In this program, we go to our meetings. We work the steps on a personal level. We develop a relationship with our higher power, and we keep in touch with our sponsor. Some days we may wonder if it's worthwhile, but most of the time the process is full and rewarding in itself. We make progress towards the ideal, although we never achieve perfection. When the challenges or threats to our sobriety come, we have our conditioning within the program to carry us through. In this day ahead, I will remember that I am building myself to peak condition. I will be faithful to my training program. And that's what I look at Alcoholics Anonymous as. It became a verb. It became an action program. It's not just people, places, and things. It's not a noun. It's something that I do. It's part of my life. And I'm a satisfied customer of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you all.